Now, I imagine most of you have been up since about 4:15, is that right? So, I better make it a little interesting. Otherwise, I should be the only person who fell asleep telling his own testimony. However, I've always been a happy kind of character, and but underneath lies a very serious nature. So, one of the things I found today, looking me in the eye, was a statement we used to fundraise with, and we put it up on big boards, and it really drilled home to me the kind of seriousness of the past when the movement was beginning. So these are the words of Father, actually, in England in 1969. I'm telling you this, and I'm telling this to you because I want you to be strong to fight for the sake of God. I want you to go to the battlefield of England. You must be the shield to protect your nation from the enemy guns. You must be able to play the role of the bullets to attack the enemy camp to win the victory. You must be able to fight for the sake of God, for the sake of yourself, and for the sake of the whole nation. If you are thus prepared, you will not be afraid of the enemy, and you will be ready to go out, and the victory will be yours, because God and the whole spiritual world will be on your side. If you are resolved as this, and if you would go out into the field, into the barren field, the wilderness, the spiritual wilderness of England, your fight will not be that of the vanquished. Even if you may die there, you will be a victor. And in the spiritual world, you will have pioneered the way for your followers. You will blossom like flowers in the garden of our Father. So, those kind of words actually rang very deep in me because I always felt, being a national leader, that the responsibility is 55 million people. That is the real responsibility. And I remember Father saying things like, you can't get out unless your 55 million people go ahead of you. And that always struck me very, very deeply. So each national leader has been here to tell his testimony, and each one is unique, different, and that is true for me too. So I've always had a great desire to actually save the entire 55 million people. Not only that, but that this nation should be used by God to smash evil as it has been in the past. And so that is my kind of very deeper, broader perhaps look at things, and I will dwell on that as we go along. But to keep you all awake, my life began in a hurry. 21 days premature, my mother gave birth to me at home, smack on the bed, and the doctor had a job winding me up, and very difficult to get me going, right? And they thought there really wasn't too much life in this one, and I was pretty dormant for a long time, actually. And I think what was happening is there's some kind of spiritual attack, because later on in my life, I went to a meeting in London, and a man drew my spiritual aura, and he went into my life, right in detail, and he told me about the circumstances of my birth and all this kind of stuff. And I went home to my mother and I said, you know, what kind of birth did I have? Oh, an ordinary, and I said, go on, tell me the real thing. I said, you know, was it the right time, for example? He said, you know, no. I was very nervous about the whole thing anyway. So I was a somewhat retarded child in many ways. You know, I used to get caught sucking the floor cloth because the floor cloth has the best taste. Things like that. Until we discovered football. Then I was known to... I used to have a music teacher just by the park where we kids used to play football.
And I used to dawdle to my music lesson. Just imagine sending me to a music lesson. On the way, I used to slave for the football and get there about 10 minutes late with
grubby fingernails and get told off for having grubby fingernails. And then, we'd have our piano session. And it took me a long year. I believe it or not, I started the piano for 4 years. It took me a year of concentrated effort to get out of it. And, anyway, that was the very early days. And then, around about 11,
10 and 11,
I kind of woke up
and
got a scholarship for the local grammar public school, and went under what I call a spiritual shock.
Having
been brought up really in the countryside, the local grammar school was public school that I went to was a real disaster. It was a real sort of highfalutin place, and it was all honour and glory, but no heart. And I was a very active person, so they used to try and make us watch the first 11 play cricket and the first 15 play football, which used to bore me to absolute tears. And we used to have to study things like Latin and French and all these other things, which used to make it even worse. And I had a roving nature and an ability to try and find some way out of these present difficulties.
It's called homework.
And
cast my eye upon
the horizon, and I found that you could go to sea at 15 and get away from it. And the only trouble is you needed fees. You had to pay for fees to go to these nautical colleges and things. And so I was able to find out that there were 2 scholarships available, and at the age of 13 and 14, I persisted in my approach with parental hostility right round my ear. Who wanted me to go on to university, but I couldn't stand the thought of staying at school, you know, more than the necessary minimum period. And not at that school anyway. And so I managed to get one of the scholarships available and went to HMS Conway, and there I really took on a new life. I must say it was a completely different environment. The discipline was very hard, but the life was very good, very vigorous for a young man. And you know, I used to really enjoy it, and we ran up hills just to prove we were fit and never get out of breath, and play football 6 days a week and anything, you know, sailing, all the activities we wanted to do. And then I went to sea, and well, it was a man's world, and I learnt to stand on my own 2 feet very early on in life. Those of you who heard me telling my testimony before, I'm sure you heard some of the humour of it. And for example, we got to Port Said on the first ship, and the junior midshipman always had to scrub the accommodation out. He was like the dog's body, kicked around by everybody. And you know, I scrubbed out the accommodation, had my bucket, and I was throwing it over the side, you see. And I never figured out somebody should be over the side, but actually there was a man painting the ship's sign underneath. I lobbed this bucket of dirty water right over the side, and it went straight over him, right? And there's a good seaman-like curse rent the air, right, with a few profundities. And round the corner came the boatswain, who was a big guy like this, and he grabbed me and he just lifted me up against the bulkhead, and he was just going like this, you know, holding me with one hand. I was just about to enter the spirit world nearly. And round the corner came the mate. He said, you know, what are you doing? And the boatswain just dropped me, and I sort of fell a bit like a stone. And that was my kind of entry to the activities at sea. And I often laugh about that because there were lots of other things, of course, that went on that caused us later to look back with considered amusement. However, it was a very active life, and we traded in the Far East, and that was a very wonderful beginning because it taught me, took me to communist China, Japan, and all those places, and worked in the Far East for 3 years, and it taught me great respect for the Orientals. I always felt we were barbarians hanging around the Orient. That's how you feel. Because the atmosphere, even like in Shanghai and places, I was amazed that you could walk down the street and you saw all these kids, little tiny tots running around at 10 o'clock at night, but never a child seeming to cry. And you could go around any English street in the afternoon and find all sorts of kids wandering around yapping their heads off. And I was really struck with part of the people. And then I sailed with ships, actually with crews, from Shanghai and Hong Kong and places. And I really got to love the Oriental people very, very deeply. And it was a great education for me. And I started to study the Oriental thought, which really caused me a lot of problems. And Confucian and Buddhist teaching and poetry and stuff. And I really realized how completely different the whole thing was. And it made me much more humble, because it's like when you're confronted with 800, well, not 800,000, million people or something, but when you're confronted with the Chinese population and you can't figure out how they think, and according to your upbringing you think they're all nuts, and you know that they're not nuts, but you must be nuts, it kind of produces in you an ability to just be a bit more careful with your own thinking, that you can't pass judgment and you must actually come to terms with a new system of logic. So on the way along, as you can gather, I was not very academic in my education, and definitely belonged to the sporting squad and not the academic squad. So they shoved Shakespeare in at the wrong end, and that was the end of my interest in English literature. I couldn't stand the stuff. And so while I was at sea, somebody gave me a book to read. It was called a Western. Now, I'd never seen a Western before, so I swallowed it. You know, I just read it from cover to cover, and I was amazed. You know, fantastic stuff. You know, plenty of action and all kinds of good guys winning in the end. And give me another one. So I used to read two a day, actually. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder one. He said, "Now, what are you reading all that trash for?" I said, "Oh, it's great stuff, you know." And so he did it about three times for me, and I said, "All right, I'll keep a list of all the books I read for the next 2 weeks, and then we can look at it." So when I did that, of course it was horrible. It was a complete disaster. You know, four-star rules of Western, all kinds of stories. And the conclusion was that I was wasting my time, right? So the next port, I forget where it was, we headed for the bookshop and collected some decent books, so-called. And I remember starting on it, and luckily I started on Plato, and you know, it was Trevelyan, rather. The first actual book was Trevelyan, The Social History of England. That's a bit dull, right? And I sort of ground through that, and then I started on Plato, and that was really good stuff. So I just went through all the classics, actually. Plato, Anaxagoras, Aristotle, and right the way, Plutarch, all the stuff I could lay my hands on, Zola, Rousseau, Tolstoy, and everything, it all went in. And I wasn't reading as a scholar would read. I was reading out of sheer interest to understand the different kinds of philosophies of thought and life. And this search for ideas, having had to tackle the Chinese population, and also communism, I remember reading the leading theoretician, Liu Shaoxi, who I think got wiped out in the purge or something in China. But I remember having to try and come to terms with all these communists and their thinking, and reading all this stuff, and really dreadful stuff. But, you know, I said to myself, it's only accident I'm a Christian. I could easily have been a Hindu or Buddhist or anything. So your conditioning, your environment, really governs how you think. And I was very interested in the search for the right kind of philosophy. And I was very conscious that one day I would have to choose between communism and democracy and the alternative. And I felt in my heart it was very important that I made the right choice. And having visited places like communist China, it wasn't so easy to make the right choice, because there were certain things there that were really horrible. And so, going along the road of life, travelling around, dealing with all sorts of merchants and shippers and Japanese businessmen who were drunk, because whenever we threw a business reception in Japan, they're always heavy drinkers, and it was always a contest as to who stayed sober the longest. And this was the world of commerce, of course. And anyway, that went on. I reached the stage
of even reading books by William James, who was wrote a book, Psychology Today, in 1894, that was it, and made a certain amount of impact on me, that things were deeper than philosophy, that there was a deeper problem. Anyway, along the line, I also learned to meditate. It was accidental, this, but, you know, I was navigating ships, and I had to spend 4 hours on the bridge in the evening, and I wanted to occupy my mind and my thoughts. So every time before I went on the bridge to navigate, I used to read a book for at least 2 hours, something decent, right? And then I used to go up on the bridge and meditate. And I used to have conversations with the spirit world. And then at 10 o'clock, for 10 months or so, the sparks used to come out of his rabbit hutch there with his sparking gear and come out for a cup of tea. And I used to give him a lesson on philosophy or whatever I was reading back. And actually, I was really taking in very deeply many things, and I was a very serious-minded person. So, when it came to life, actually, we had a lot of difficulty in one or two places, and the worst place in particular was Indonesia, where one or two of our officers had been stabbed, and we had some very difficult moments there. And I remember saying to God once, okay, if you survive this kind of difficult moment, I'll donate my talents to you when I'm 21, you see. And it's a bit kind of rash thing to do early on, but I knew God really was God, and I was brought up in a very good Christian way by my father, who took me to church and explained Christianity, and I was confirmed, and I went to sea. And then we came back, and I was sitting on a bus in London, and I got a lovely good vision. Time to give up pushing ships around, do something for me. So that was very clear, that having qualified as a navigating officer, that I should do something worthwhile. And my nature was to choose the most worthwhile thing and the difficult thing that I could find. And that was that it was very clear to me that the world of understanding about the nature of man, the psychology man, was the field that really needed to be explored, because there was a wide open field in there. And the result was I determined to go to university. So of course everybody said, you must be mad, you're not an academic, you're barking up the wrong tree. So I went to the local technical college to qualify, and I saved up my money, of course, while I was at sea. So they couldn't understand this character who attended with great diligence. It was really interesting, all kinds of people there, majority of whom failed the exams, and there was me, who I really grounded out, right? I used to run a service for all the other students, and I used to do my homework and then farm it out, right? And I used to get it back the next morning just before the class, and, you know, used to serve my fellow students with great skill while they played darts and poker and cards and generally had a holiday. And so I had a problem. I had to get my A-levels in 1 year to enter university, which, for being away from that kind of activity, was a very heavy program. And again, I got involved in a local activity with a local philosopher. And there was an itinerary course on philosophy, and I used to go to it with the local newspaper editor and some good old salts of the trade union movement and businessmen and one or two local ministers. We used to get our heads together. They were all over about 40 and 50, and I was the youngest person on the stand, you know, about 25 or 24 or 23, I don't know, sometime about that. And at the same time as carrying out that program, I was, of course, actively playing my favourite sports as usual, and having a very zealous and interesting time. And I managed to get by the skin of my teeth into university on basically, I'm afraid, my native ability rather than my academic honour. Anyway, we got in, and so by now I was pretty familiar. I used to go to church, you know, and I used to, not many people could really understand me, because like I had a religious life and a very serious life. I used to go to church on Sundays regularly, and then I had my sporting life. Most of those guys I played sport with were sort of boozers, and, you know, not much good for anything else somehow. And then there was my sort of philosophical life, and they were a bunch of old cronies. And then there was my sort of A-level life, which were a bunch of playabouts. And nobody actually connected You know, it's just like going to different worlds all the time. And then zooming off. And of course, I was really full of great idealism because I went to search for the truth. And I never had any understanding what a real university was like. And so when I went there, you know, I was absolutely appalled. It was like a doss house. It was a glorious hangout. And I was literally quite shaken to find the lethargy in the students there. And so straight away, I, you know, attacked the central issues of psychology. And we came to blows straight away on the nature of science. And spiritually, I've always known I had a very kind of active mind on basic principles. So the professor, who was my mentor and guide, found himself up with a person who challenged everything he ever did say. And we had a long struggle, as I'm sure you all heard about. And it reached a stage where by now I was into spiritual healing and got into that and really understood the spirit world quite well and meditated regularly in the morning. And one of the students had many spiritual experiences, as usual. And a practical example of this was I used to run the United Nations Students Association at university. And I remember when I was meditating, I used to meditate every morning at 6 o'clock. And I remember some Tibetan spirits came to me and said they were starving, right? And I, of course, didn't listen. I said, you know, you really can't starve in the spirit world. And they said, no, we're not starving. Our refugees are starving. So I said, you know, where are they? And they said, Nepal. And I said, well, what could I do? And they said, well, you must try and do something. So I remember writing to Lord Carradine, who then was the ambassador, I think, to the United Nations, who I'd had some connection with before. So I wrote to him, and he forwarded my letter on to the Foreign Office, and they sent me back an advance of a reply, saying, you know, they couldn't do anything because the Indian government wanted to keep good relations with China. So I sent back my usual little right hand with a fierce bit of logic in, saying, you know, good relations with China, no excuse for men starving. You know, what kind of philosophy do you operate on? So they sent back a reply saying, well, if you will come to London, we can talk about it. So I sent back another reply saying something like, I don't need to come to London to talk about it, you must do something. And they sent back another reply saying, well, you must come and talk about it. Well, there was me, an ordinary student at university, so I got on the train and came down to the Foreign Office here, number 11 Downing Street, or 12 Downing Street, and, you know, presented myself and said, you know, here I am, I've come to see something about the Tibetan refugees, and they, with, you have a guy takes you right up, and I don't know, fourth floor or somewhere, and we went into a room, and there was a, they got all these secret maps out, and had all the camps marked on, and some chap, I suppose he was like the Central Asian Secretary or something, and there's some sort of character there, and he said, you know, we've got 70,000 refugees there, but what can we do? So against the Nepalese Indian border, and we had a long discussion about it, basically with me arguing that, you know, to hoots with the Indian government, because if men are starving, you've got to do something, you see. And then he said, well, how do you know all this? So I said, I've got friends. So anyway, we argued for about 2 hours, and then he took me to lunch. You see, being a poverty-stricken student, of course, the lunch cost about £2.10 in those days. And I thought, my gosh, you know, they spent more on lunch, two wines and all this stuff, than I spend on my entire food bill in all week. And you know, we went to this very sort of plush place, and when I came out of there and caught the train, like spirit, well, these spirits came back to me and they said, you know, that lunch was our treat for your endeavour. So I had different experiences like this several times, and my relationship with the spirit world, luckily, because of my Christian background, was very good. I didn't take from the spirit world, but basically served and loved God and mankind as well as I could. So the relationship wasn't just a spiritualist type relationship. So then, while I was at university,
as I said, I used to have these monumental arguments about the nature of man. And I remember in my second year, I went in to sort my professor out. I was a great guy at sorting them out, right? And I got a big load of books, you know, and I had diagrams of the aura and how the spirit works and, you know, quotes from the Bible and everything. And I went in to see him and I said, I want to talk to you seriously about the nature of man. And he said, oh, sit down, you know. And so for 20 minutes, I held forth. And I said, now, what do you think? And he said, you must be some kind of fool. He said, I think you're hallucinated or something like this, you see. So I left, looked at him, and I said, thought to myself, Mike, he's really ignorant. He's hopeless, right? So I said, you know, do you realize you deny the entire authority of the Bible? And he said, look, he said, if you want to discuss the Bible, you go to the Department of Divinity and don't waste my time. And so we had those kind of problems. And I remember coming out, you know, and Heavenly Father used to come to me, I'm certain of that, and I used to feel a great warmth and a great joy. And I knew that I was battling against, like, the ignorance of the 20th century. So I kept that up for my 3 years and reached the stage of my final exams and again argued the case vigorously right the way down the line. And they told me bluntly that that was the wrong thing to do and I should come back again in a year's time and have thought better. And so I said, you know, nonsense. And you have to prove my thinking wrong, I said, if you want me to change it. Just believing something is no value anyway. We parted company right there, and then I made the great mistake of coming first to the party to celebrate the graduates. They had a graduation party, and there was only one person who didn't graduate, and that was me. So I thought, why miss out on the fun, you know? Dennis, boy, you spent 3 years arguing the case here, so have a bit of fun, you know, last day. And I turned up first, and of course there was the professor and all these guys. I thought, my gosh, you know, the bad guy walked in again, you know. And as I came around the corner happily, you know, their faces fell, you know. You know, look what turned up, look what rolled in. So, you know, they detailed a nice senior lecturer to look after me, of course, you know. So I said to him, I said, you know, you've done me a great favour today. And they said, you know, what do you mean? I said, well, do you realize, I said, that I will stay saner longer than you, I said. If I spent my life in psychology, I would probably go around the bend, I said, like most of the people in it. But I said, I'm a free man. And I need to go around the bend, right? So we had a bit of fun that night, and Heavenly Father's often cheered me up in the moment. And then I set about writing a spiritual psychology. So I wrote something about 30,000 words on psychology into pure science, 1966, something like that it was called. I wrote it anyway to try and straighten people out. And I was thinking of emigrating to America, and I wrote to various places like University of Washington and MIT about my ideas, which I tried to push here, and I couldn't get any real support for them, although I had one or two distinguished academics on my side, including a leading pathologist, a college of surgeons here, and a professor of applied physics of different people, and a professor of logic. But I couldn't really get anything going in this country, so I was really thinking, well, it's time to emigrate and go to America where they've got a bit broader ideas. And I set about to try and fulfill something spiritual first. And I remember one day I was praying about it. It was in my mind to visit all the holy places of England, because I felt once I leave this country I shall never come back to it, and I don't ever want to have anything to do with the academic world here and get away from the whole thing. And so I was really praying what to do, and I got my answer very clearly: give up my job, give up my car, give notice on my flat. And so a friend took me up to Scotland, and there I joined a community that they call the Sinton Group in the very beginning, and I helped them along for a while, and used to pray and meditate every day. And then God really protected me many times, actually. And over the next 18 months, I actually visited all the New Age groups in the country, and I actually hitchhiked all over the country with amazing precision. And I really learned that, like, God worked in split seconds, and timing is very important. And we had a chap wandering around the country called Sir Anthony Brooke, who
was the first Englishman to hear Prince in 1964. Doris, I think, witnessed to him in Los Angeles or somebody did. And he went to Korea and he stood up and spoke out to Father, and he came back to this country and he started teaching principle, but never telling anybody it was Father. It was his principle, and he used principle for himself. So he went around the country giving these lectures about, you know, the nature of man and different things. And, you know, I listened to them. I thought, fantastic, you know, he's a wonderful man. He knows more about it than anybody else. And I was a sort of follower of his. And so I was sort of living chapter one without understanding that this was actually divine principle. And I heard of Sun Myung Moon. So I used to ask, you know, what did he do? And I was studying all the religious groups and teachings. Well, the day came when, having wondered why God kept me in the highlands so long, always when I left, God led me back there. And I knew that in the mountains and by the sea, I was there for a specific purpose. And I'd known that God was working through my life for a long time, actually, because I had many deep experiences while I was at sea, many deep experiences while I was at university, many deep experiences with spiritual healing. And I knew absolutely that my interest was to serve God, and God was leading me from one chapter to another and showing me many things. So the moment came when Doris arrived in the top of Scotland to teach his principle. We heard that Reverend Moon, well, in those days we called him Sun Myung Moon's representative, was coming. And so we invited her to come and teach us. And she arrived in a gale of a wind, and she looked quite ill when she arrived. And you all know her testimony, how she resisted a severe attack of spirit world to come and find me. And I was leading a pretty healthy life in those days. I was a real John the Baptist, you know, vegetarian to the very ends, and the rest of the world was unevolved. And I swam in the sea in northern Scotland from February to November. Every day went for a dip in the old ocean. And I was really pretty healthy and vigorous, right? To a shambles now. And so when she turned up, I mean, it was nothing actually to get revelation. I used to get them fairly regularly, and spirit world was a normal part of my life. And so first of all, I received a beautiful revelation that it was true. That was unusual. I never had one like that before. And you know, I thought, if it's true, I must really pay attention. You know, save thinking, don't you? You're told it's true. You don't have to figure it out whether it is or not. All you've got to do is understand it. So then I received another one that I should protect her. I thought, protect her from what? You know, what's up here? Nothing, you know, in the wilderness, right? But I realized afterwards, when she taught chapter two, sort of all hell broke loose in the spirit. Because when she taught chapter two, a lot of the people up there got chapter two problems. So there was a big campaign to get rid of her. You know, that was enough. We'd heard enough. You know. What, 12 chapters? Choose enough, right? Get rid of her. So right there, the spiritual group that I was in was split. And they organized an alternate program to stop you listening to her. And there were three of us stood with her, and the rest all went to these alternate sort of activities. And then, of course, I had a job on a millionaire's estate, and he was never there. And so we arranged it to have lectures in the morning, then I would go and do my work, and then lectures in the evening. And I was fasting at the same time because I wanted to make certain I understood everything, and I didn't fall asleep because I had too much to eat or anything. And at the same time, this is a very beautiful estate. It was a whiskey millionaire's estate, and you know, there was two gardeners, one bloke and me, and we sort of ran it. And you know, I used to meditate in the gardens there, and I used to have most beautiful experiences. And Father appeared to me right there and spoke to me in the spirit, and had a long conversation. But you know, we realized, like, it's Heavenly Father appearing when Father appears. And so I was quite struck, right? You know, I had kind of all kinds of revelations with it, you might say. We used to call them the elect in the spirit world. And just before Doris came, I remember now, Jesus appeared to me in the evening before Doris came, and it was a very beautiful experience. And I was reading a religious book at the time, and Jesus came into the room, and the radiance was so bright that I was absolutely overwhelmed by the spiritual intensity. And Jesus kind of blessed me. in a very beautiful way. And I was very alert spiritually, because I knew if Jesus blessed me, there was something definite going to happen. So when Doris came the next day, I was really alert to whatever was going to transpire. And so Doris cooked a meal for me, and it was a roast leg of lamb. I shall always remember this meal to the